When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Quit laughing.
I'm trying.
Welcome to Gola. I'm Katie Parla, a Rome-based food and beverage writer, culinary guide, and cookbook author.
And I'm Danielle Caligari, an assistant professor in Italian at Dartmouth College and a certified specialist of wine.
Hi, I'm Shannon McHugh. I'm an assistant professor of French and Italian at the University of Massachusetts Boston. I'm here on behalf of the university's Catherine Frisone Scott Center for Italian Cultural Studies to welcome our students from UMass and elsewhere, our colleagues from the university and all over, all the Gola listeners, and most importantly, our podcast hosts for this event, our live virtual taping of the podcast Gola. Our hosts are, of course, Danielle Caligari and Katie Parla. As a dedicated fan myself, I have literally listened to every single episode. For a while last year, I was making it a habit to immediately go out and eat whatever they talked about. At this time of year, I particularly want to recommend the Immaculate Conception episode about Italian fruitcakes. I just want to sincerely thank Danielle and Katie for being with us, for allowing UMass to be a part of this event. When we started talking with Danielle and Katie about doing something, we all decided that a good topic might be seafood. It felt like a natural fit given Boston's strong Italian-American community and proximity to the sea, as well as the nearness to Christmas time and the famous or infamous, depending on your point of view, Italian-American Feast of the Seven Fishes. And we are actually by the ocean, strangely, at this moment, although not the ocean we were first meant to be by. Through pandemic and also serendipity, the three of us have found ourselves in Venice Beach, California. We are safely and socially distantly recording this episode from three different parts of the property. But it's nice that we all three can be close together. And before I turn it over to Danielle and Katie, let me just say that the format of today's episode is going to be the first half, we're going to let our hosts chat together. And then the whole second half is designed to be a Q&A based on questions that you all are submitting. So I really especially want to encourage the students from UMass Boston and other schools to throw any and every question y'all have ever had about seafood and Italy or seafood and Italian-American cooking into that Q&A. And let me say specifically that I want to encourage everybody to use that chat freely, but the questions will get lost in the Zoom chat. So make sure you click on that Q&A icon at the bottom of your screen and put your question in that way so that we're able to keep track of everybody's questions and feed them over to our hosts. And without further ado, I will go ahead and hand this episode over to Danielle and Katie. Thanks again.
Thanks for having us. I'm Katie Parla.
And I'm Danielle Caligari. I'm delighted, as always, to be here with my friend Katie Parla, and absolutely privileged and honored to be a guest of Professor Shannon McHugh and the Department of Italian. I believe they're actually Romance Languages and Classics at UMass. Well, she'll correct me later. And the Frisone Fund. It's so much fun to be doing this. I think both of us, I'll speak for Katie for a second, because we've been together for at a safe distance for a day now. And I know we both have been pretty run ragged with all of the trying to readapt our lives to the current conditions. And we knew we had this on the horizon, but we didn't have a lot of time to focus and reflect on how pleasurable it would be to get to do this event with everyone here. And it's just so much fun. So thanks everyone for coming. And Katie, let's just get right into it. Tell us about Italian seafood. Why did we decide to talk about this today?
It's one of the most diverse topics when it comes to proteins that I can think of. And for those who've been to Italy, or if you've simply just seen Italy on a map, you know that the country has a really, really long coastline. And it's touched by several seas. It has lagoons, it has lakes, rivers. And so there's just so much fish to talk about. And I think that's why I'm so excited to chat with you today. We need like 5 hours, but let's just sort of break it down. Like, what is, when I say fish, that translates to pesce in Italian, but in Italy, the concept of fish is much greater. It encompasses not just seafood, frutti di mare. There's a whole sort of massive universe of lagoon critters. It's a very big category. And for some, it even extends into other non-fish species. And I'm just thinking, I love to think about how in Rome, fishermen used to fish for eels. Now there's one guy, but it used to be like a thing, but like they would catch perch and eel and they would just sort of be presented as fish. So an eel aren't fish. So.
No, that's exactly... You're absolutely right. And it's true. There's the kind of fish culture that we talk about when we think of it in Italy. It came up immediately when we were talking about how to frame our discussion, because exactly when you translate back into Italian, talking about seafood, you don't really have the same terminology. So there's not a smooth translation from Italian to English. We talk about frutti di mare. We talk about pesce di mare. We talk about pesce di lago. We talk about the bodies of water that they're associated with and regional specialties that often have radically different dialectic names that are not only not translatable, but because they don't even exist in other spaces, are not represented linguistically. So the richness of that space is something that can be overwhelming, even as just a regular diner in places where you can look at a menu and find such a variety of things that you are totally unable to decipher. And also because there will be many things that you're unfamiliar with. But it's because, like all the food that we talk about on the podcast and in our studies, fish in particular has kind of encompasses and encapsulates this ultimate aspect of Italian culinary culture, which is hyper regionality and hyper locality. People in Italy, while we think about, I think what's part of the kind of grander imaginary is these massive steel trays with ice and a fresh catch from the Mediterranean that morning, loaded up with shellfish especially, and then really large saltwater fish. In fact, what most people are thinking about when it comes to eating fish in their Italian space is something that's very specific to that place. So if you come from Florence, where I make my Italian home, you will hear from people there saying that unfortunately you just can't get fish here because they're too far from the sea. By an American standard, that's insane, because in Florence, if you drive and you abide the speed limit, you are at the Tyrrhenian in less than 90 minutes. So you could actually catch fish and bring it home without ice and still eat it safely. But the understanding of eating something local in Italy means very local. You can walk to get it, basically, or walk to fish it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think we talk a lot about how Italian food culture and the availability of ingredients was really radically changed in the modern age. So we're talking like post-war, 60s and 70s, when refrigeration, ice, freezing water to make blocks of ice for preserving fish and other things became much more common. And that was followed by a really rapidly expanding international fish industry. And there's a millennial history of large-scale fishing operations in the Mediterranean, across the Mediterranean world. But anything that was companies that were formed in Sicily or Sardinia, even at the peak of those markets, are microscopic in comparison to the international fishing industry that allows now for things that aren't totally local to arrive all over the peninsula. And when you visit a market in Naples, yes, you are very, very likely to see wriggling octopi, anchovies, and other small oily fish still in the throes of rigor mortis, so fresh, plucked out of the sometimes sketchy waters of the Bay of Naples. And meanwhile, when I am in Rome, which is 13 miles from the sea, so it is considered distant from the sea, there the fish culture is really new in a way, at least the diversity of fish that's available. And pre-war, like, Romans were definitely eating perch and they were eating cod and anchovies, skate. But today you can walk through the market, and my favorite is Mercato Trionfale. They have really wonderful fish stalls, and you'll see in big capital letters on the labels, locale, if something's local, and then FAO 37, which is the generic code for the Mediterranean basin, if it's not from Anzio or one of the ports near Rome. But still, I think from consumption standpoint, it's the local fish that are more attached to traditional recipes that really dominate. Like Romans don't have to eat salt cod anymore. They have a lot of fresh fish available, but they do out of tradition and because it's delicious, and especially when deep fried or cooked with chickpeas or really in any incarnation. But we'll get more into the cod specialties later. I was prompted a bit by that early question in the chat.
No, I think what you were just saying leads us straight into one of the kind of larger themes that we wanted to approach, which is not having to eat fish, but eating it in some way anyway. And the big question of why do Italians eat fish versus something else, or when do they and how do they, right? And the, you know, I'm always kind of pushing back against determinative models and the idea that people are eating something out of necessity or convenience. But of course, there is obviously a kind of lurking reality that we have to acknowledge, which is Italy is a giant peninsula surrounded by water and with a number of rivers and estuaries that run through it and substantial lakes. So many people live close to a body of water, and most of them will, of course, have some access to that and use that as easy access to calories historically and also contemporarily. But there are also many other reasons for which Italians eat fish, and the ways or that kind of help to draw the contours around how they eat fish. One is an obvious one that probably is more often than not cited, and that's because of a faith practice. Most Italians still today identify as Catholic, and most of them, often without even knowing it consciously, follow a liturgical calendar that imposes fasting on Fridays throughout the year and on several other high holy days, in addition to Advent Sundays, for example, coming up, and the Lenten period preceding Easter. We can make a contrast here with the understanding of what it means to really practice a faith or be faithful versus to have a kind of vague cultural cloud of that around you. But the same way that American public schools still serve pizza on Friday because of a Judeo-Christian tradition imposing a fast on that day, so too many Italians eat fish on certain days and in certain ways because of this kind of underlying Catholic current that carries them in that direction. There are, of course, lots of other reasons, though. Katie, you think often about markets, about local economies in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, as we were saying, there are vast parts of Italy that are touched by the sea or by lakes, rivers, bodies of water that have food in them. And over the course of centuries, millennia even, there have been certain hubs where local fishing has become really the anchor of a local economy. And I'm thinking of places like the southwestern coast of Sardinia, the southern coast of Sicily, the western and northern coast of Sicily, certainly the Venetian Lagoon. And those places, and particularly because of the absence of refrigeration and the difficulty with which things were moved around, those are places where fresh fish dishes would be consumed and where salted fish dishes would be produced and then distributed for consumption in landlocked parts of Italy. And in the creation of these fish-based economies, there's also this thriving marketplace. And I referenced Naples before, but it could be any coastal city. You're more likely to find things that are hyper-local there than elsewhere, because starting in the 1970s, there was a sort of deliberate elongating of the supply chain for many foods. And so large fishing industries could supply fish to a central wholesale for a city, even a city as landlocked as Milan, and then allow for distribution within that place in styrofoam containers and overflowing with ice, things that were totally absent before that period. And, you know, speaking of Milan, it's a city that is one of the largest consumers of fish in Italy. Look at it on a map. It's close to some lakes, but it's pretty far from the sea. And that brings us to another important cultural characteristic associated with seafood. It's a status symbol. It's expensive to have a whole fish. It is an occasion to go out to eat fish. And you might start with raw seafood and then move into your cooked starters and then have your pasta with some sort of seafood or fish, then your whole fish under salt or under a crust of potatoes. And then, of course, all of this is accompanied with wine. So you can imagine that the price tag of this meal is considerable and not one that is accessible to everyone every day. And so fish based restaurants, ones that are specifically aimed at serving just fish dishes, allow you to demonstrate your wealth. But because of the sort of homogenization of dishes in such a category, there's now more variety than ever. And Milan is also the capital of sushi restaurants in Italy. Sometimes you find sushi spelled S-U-S-H-I, and sometimes you find it spelled S-U-S-C-I as a fun and flirty, like, Italian word.
Well, I, besides being fun and flirty, regional specialties like that are everywhere. And Milan has the preponderance of them because of the significant population concentration, the concentration of wealth there, obviously. And because although it is a very much internal city, as Italians would describe it, it is also reached easily by tributaries from rivers that lead out towards what used to be the capitals of the Byzantine Empire. But regional specialties outside of places like Milan, where there isn't as much diversity within the city, can become even more precious economically as a result of that. And those are things that have sort of become universes unto themselves within the world of Italian seafood. I'm thinking, for example, of one that you and I bring up all the time, which is Botarga, which is, how do we describe it in English? Salted row of fish, of flathead mullet.
Oh, sorry, Botarga di Mugine is flathead mullet, but Botarga in general, I'm sorry.
Could be any of these, right, dried salted eggs, which doesn't sound terribly appealing in its English description, and is probably a stronger flavor than a lot of Americans are used to enjoying regularly, but that is in any... First of all, delicious, period. And second of all, a delicacy, something to be celebrated and to be used celebratorily. And those kinds of Botarga in particular is coming from Sicily and Sardinia. Katie pointed out earlier that the Mugine in particular is a very unique specialty of Sardinia. And these kinds of products are now the kinds of things that no one needs them to have the longevity that they're able to attain. Nobody must eat them to create the umami flavor in place of not having other things. They're enjoyed and they're brought out because of the fact that they are rare and hard to make and are bring out this very special, very specific local seafood culture.
Yeah, absolutely. And also speak to the now defunct tradition of using every possible part of the fish, treating it in the ways that a butcher would treat a pig, really just using organs and coaxing out wonderful flavors using something as simple as salt. Anchovies are also one of those, let's say, Tyrrhenian coastal specialties, although they're found elsewhere, but very, very deeply connected to the Tyrrhenian coast, where they're consumed in a myriad of ways. Fresh anchovies can be gutted and floured or battered and fried. I like this one. Actually, you know, I love salted anchovies, and you can find them in tin, under salt. You can find them cured already under oil, and those produce a really rich umami note in whatever you're introducing them to, whether it's sauteing with vegetables or melting in oil and tossing with pasta. Those are really intensely flavorful manifestations of that food. And then, of course, Collatura di Alici is the byproduct of salting and allowing sort of gravity to press this anchovy elixir out of the fish over the course of years, ideally, although there are some productions that speed up the process, and using that elixir, a few drops in a dish of pasta or vegetables in order to elevate the flavors.
Another, I always get like totally distracted by the mention of Collatura, because I had like an intelligent response, and I was like, I wonder if we could get Collatura later. Who would have it? Anyway, there are a couple places. Thanks to you, mostly. The other kind of specialty product that I think comes up when we're talking about things that kind of orient you regionally, and that you brought up before, and that can help us to transition also into more specific dishes, is the cod question, right? Stoccafisso, baccalà will be the term more familiar to Italian Americans. Salt cod comes out in many forms, is used historically all the time. Now, as you mentioned earlier, Katie, it is more frequently used in tandem with a holiday or with certain times of year because of its because of its traditional associations and not because of a need to maintain fish in this dry and salted way. But because of that long history and because of those roots that it has, and because it was able to travel with ease, it is a sort of pan-Italian specialty in a certain sense, because almost everyone makes it some way. It is special and regional in another aspect, because each place has its own kind of tradition associated with it. And it is both a very resonant piece of cucina povera, of something that can that doesn't need refrigeration, that can last for a very long time, but then also that carries with it a kind of sense of something festive, because it was brought out in tandem with holidays. So cod is actually in itself a kind of micro universe here, where you can just explode the idea of what it means to eat fish in an Italian context, and all of the kind of social, historical, economic, religious, and other practices can be teased out of this one fish. How do we see cod now, Katie? And what are some of the ways that it's kind of being presented around the peninsula?
Well, I just always think it's so interesting that a fish that's caught far from Italian waters is actually the fish that unites most Italian regional and sub-regional cuisines. And it wasn't just consumed in landlocked places. One of the most common ways to prepare salt cod is baccalà mantecato, a really like sort of creamy spread that's served in Venice and the environs. Cod is often the protein present in a stew that's really richly flavored with tomato sauce, pine nuts, raisins, and onions. This is a preparation that's called baccalà alla romana, a name that actually erases the Jewish origins of this dish. Battered and fried cod is common on holiday tables, especially for the Vigilia di Natale, but is also a fast food, sort of snack food that you can find in cities like Rome. And cod is sold reconstituted on Thursdays, so you can take, and Fridays too, in markets and at alimentari. So you can take it home and prepare it, and each city has its sort of traditional cod dish or multiple that would be served on Fridays, whether the cook is a practicing Catholic or not. There's still the tradition of venerdì pesce, fish on Friday. I love a fish Friday.
I mean, who doesn't?
Or the pizza Friday too.
No complaints either.
Curious. Got your clam pizza any day of the week, though. That's what's great about it.
We redirect to the Northeast.
This is an elaborate ad for Pepe's in New Haven. So you're going to find fish in restaurants dedicated specifically to fish. You're going to find them in restaurants that serve a lot of different things, but maybe just on Friday, or at least a limited selection of fish. And then what people cook at home is totally dependent on their budget and what is locally available to them. And so not unlike shopping for fish in North America. You know what I really like when you talk about the like fish alternatives and salamanders?
Okay, we probably should turn over to our questions soon, because I see they're piling up, but I will grant you this one wish, Katie, on this So, right, all the reasons that we talked about are reasons for which people eat fish in Italy. But of course, the thing that I didn't emphasize that I'm always so keen to is that at the end of the day, it's also for the taste, right? Fish is delicious. Mediterranean fish is delicious. The smaller bodies of water that surround Italy and are within Italy produce a great diversity of seafood that makes for exciting and tasty things. That drive has led people to try to find alternatives for fish when they can't have it, and vice versa has led people to try to get certain animals that we wouldn't consider to be fish to be considered them, so that they could open up the possibilities of what they could eat on a fast day. So the category of fish has been sort of pressed in both directions at different times. When it comes to people wishing they had fish and they don't have it, we have one of my favorites, the spaghetti alle vongole fugliate. So spaghetti with clams that have escaped, which is just making spaghetti alle vongole as you would, but without clams, and then hoping that you made the sauce tasty enough and beautiful enough that when you eat it, you will feel as though clams were present. pesce povero, which is basically just a mashed potato pile with, some people make it in a better way, but it's often just a kind of form of potatoes that is made to look like a fish and has this. So if you have a mom who's nice enough at home or a friend who's caring enough to go in and put in the detail, it'll have little scales and a little fish face on it, in addition to having the shape and the fins. On the other hand, when it comes to having to eat fish, particularly in a long history window, we see when Italy was a place where fasting was taken more seriously or imposed more seriously by Catholic institutions that often acted as community organizational principles. So as a result of that, had a greater influence on day-to-day life also. They would then be looking for more things to kind of jazz up your days of fish only eating. And those were the times where you see people writing to their bishop to ask if it was okay to eat a salamander, which is often water adjacent and spends much time in the water. Anything that was sort of in a hybrid state, frogs, waterfowl, were all pressed to be interpreted as fish as a result of their desire to have something that wasn't, for example, the cod that many people were eating on most Fridays, many Wednesdays, and lots of other high holy days if they weren't lucky enough to be, for example, on the Bay of Naples. I do enjoy a good salamander once in a while, although they're terribly hard to find these days.
Thank you. I said, no. What's not hard to find these days are questions abounding about seven fishes. What is the deal? So we both grew up in American in the tri-state area. Seven fishes were like what you had to put on the table, although some families would use eel too. Eel's a fish. I said it wasn't a fish. Is eel a fish? I thought it was an amphibian. I don't know. It's one of those in-between things. Anyway, eel, cod, clams, shrimp, crab, all these things on the table. Got to hit that number seven of dishes or you failed somehow. That's an Italian-American tradition. In an Italian setting, I always say, like, if you just serve seven fishes, you are disappointing your guests.
That's definitely true. Even on a non-Christmas feast of fishes, most people are putting out many, many dishes, especially on a Christmas, on a Vigilia kind of menu. You would have, and I think so first of all, to answer the question head on, most people in Italy don't abide by that constriction. Most people haven't actually heard of that. It's not a purely American invention, but it is an Italian-American kind of reinforcement of that specific policy that made it so popular here. And it's not something that you really hear about in Italy or that people practice specifically. When it comes to the holiday on the Christmas Eve vigil, people are eating fish. But the connection I was thinking of, Katie, was something that you kind of alluded to before, but I don't know if we said very specifically. It also kind of, it works in tandem with this idea that if you're eating fish, you're eating fish. You don't have fish and then also have meat in the meal. It's a fish meal or it's a meat meal. So Christmas Eve is a fish meal. And so it doesn't, whatever number of courses there are, whatever number of various dishes come to the table, they will all be fish. You will not have meat also. They just simply don't go together in that mindset. Partly also because of a question of taste, right? The idea is that fish is more delicate. Fish has has different textures, has less fat in it. And so your palate responds differently. And because you're going to be drinking wine along with it, and certain wines are going to pair better with your fish dishes and wouldn't translate to heavier meat dishes. So I think in my mind, when it comes to Christmas Eve, most Italians are just thinking, I'm making an abundant fish meal. And there may be dozens of things on the table that are represented. Yeah.
So Lorenzo is curious about how Italian seafood in the early modern era was affected by the exploration of the New World and the importation of new food products.
Well, this is a great question. Although I would say short answer is immediately, like all things, not very much. It took a long time. They call it the blunted impact in academic lingo. It took a long time for food ways at especially kind of larger scale levels to change dramatically. And the ways that they mostly changed dramatically were agriculturally. Fish, again, more for reasons of a kind of cultural interpretation rather than real logistical impossibility, was not something that most people would transfer long distances, with the exception of salt cod, which had this longstanding developed industry from with an exchange from north of Europe to south. The huge difference that you see, I think, is very much, first of all, a certainly post-war, but I would actually say really last 30 years or so, when you see the opening up of Italian, especially public dining spaces, e.g. restaurants, other kinds of spaces where people exchange more, have access, especially through American television, through other kind of outside cultural influences, and open up the culinary scene more broadly. And I would say that this is to some extent an opinion. This is an informed opinion, but it's an opinion. But I would say that the kinds of fish and the ways in which fish is eaten in Italy has changed more probably over the last 10 to 15 years than it had in the preceding centuries. Yeah.
So another question from Q&A MVP Jason. How has overfishing changed Italian dining? Are there dishes that were common 50 years ago that are rare or non-existent now? Absolutely.
This is all you. Yeah.
Fishing has been absolutely devastating for availability of some fish, the reproduction of others, and the European Union and other bodies have imposed serious restrictions on fishing for species that come with monetary fines that large fishing companies just pay after violating the rules. So there will be bans on certain types of seafood and fish. Whitebait, for example, is supposed to be banned, and you will always find places serving it. Nevertheless, you're not supposed to serve sea urchins in a certain period. You're not supposed to fish for tuna or even anchovies in certain periods. So it's been really devastating. And the overfishing, which is really geared towards tuna in large parts of the Mediterranean fishing industry, has led to vanishing of things like your tuna heart, all sorts of like internal tuna organ dishes, and just like the full processing of large fish so that each part is used. There's a lot of waste as a result.
And I mean, that's something that we could talk about at great length and is important for people to be aware of. It works on both sides, but as no doubt it becomes clear just from what Katie has told us, the fallout from that is that should be that some dishes aren't served anymore and should be that some things aren't around, but people are not always abiding it. So it falls to the consumer at that point. And so it's something that we should all be careful about. One of the current Italian majors at UMass Boston, Molly, wants to hear more about eating raw seafood in Italy. And this is actually perfect because Katie asked me right before we went to bed last night, what is your favorite fish thing to eat in Italy? All the things and all the possible dishes. And the very first thing I said was, I love the very most of all raw pink shrimp that it can be fished in a few different places in the south of Italy. But for me, it's plucked right out of the bay in front of Palermo, where you can get a lot of very weird and definitely sketchy fish that is prepared literally port side. But I will just suck their little bodies right out of their heads any day, all day of any week.
And yeah, like raw fish is served simply, it's called carpaccio when it's sliced, as a meat carpaccio might be. It's generally seasoned very sparingly, sometimes just a bit of olive oil drizzled on top, salt. Pink peppercorns are really in fashion also with carpaccio. Like, it's nuts in a way, but it's also whatever, fine. And yeah, the mixed frutti di mare, like thing, the huge plate that you can order it at amazing like Sardinian restaurants or Sicilian restaurants tends to have like a pretty wide variety, lots of like furry shelled mussels and lots of barnacles and even sea snails, things that don't really have analogs here in North America. This is my favorite question, Maureen. Thank you for asking it. Is it still forbidden to use cheese in or on a fish? The answer is yes and no. It is forbidden to put grated Parmigiano Reggiano on fish. I don't know of an exception. I don't I can't name one. I can name 150,000 recipes in which pecorino romano and fish are combined, or pecorino sardo. Basically, I think the general rule still stands that Parmigiano and other cow-based cheeses are not combined with fish, unless they're mozzarella. Then you can go nuts. And I think specifically of salted anchovies combined with mozzarella and stuffed into a zucchini blossom and battered and fried. There's also a really popular combo of burrata and raw shrimp. That's like, it's not a traditional thing, but it's something you'll find in like the sort of finer dining, fish-oriented restaurants of Puglia, Sicily, all the way up the peninsula into Milan, even though neither red shrimp nor burrata are native to that city. And yeah, just like, don't put your Parmigiano on top of your spaghetti with clams, but do explore the possibilities of having mussels with spaghetti grated with a little bit of pecorino on top. It's a classic in Sardinia. It's so delicious. Recommend. Thanks for that.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the thing that probably helps to contextualize that for people who haven't spent as much time eating in Italy is that there are a lot of other non-fish dishes where you're not allowed to put cheese. So if you're in Rome, for example, and you have an arrabbiata and you ask for cheese, they'll be like, absolutely not. There, anything where one other flavor is supposed to be decisive, you shouldn't be trying to detract or confuse that flavor with something, especially like Parmigiano, which has this incredible depth. And that's so expensive and prestigious also if it's made properly. And so I think once you learn that, you kind of understand where the no fish, no cheese on fish dishes comes from. It's more of a question of, is this cheese appropriate for this plate? And that should be a question that in theory is asked and in every situation. Yeah.
So there are a lot of questions about the authenticity of certain dishes, like squid ink pasta, Italian or Italian-American. Cuttlefish ink is used in pasta and risotto dishes in Venice and elsewhere for that matter, but it's really sort of synonymous with Venice. But I haven't lived in America since college, so I don't know its prevalence or how it manifests in the US. So maybe you can take that one, Danielle, and also the lobster fra diavolo.
Okay, so authenticity question, broad answer is that almost all of them have some original, if you want, iteration in Italy, or in any case, an Italian version of something, Italian peninsular version of something, and then that was translated into another context and manipulated in some way. So when it comes to all of these things, you'll probably find something that existed in Italy or some kind of parallel or analog that exists in Italy, and that was changed. And it might be changed a bunch of times. So it might have changed when it traveled within Italy. It might have then changed when it moved to other places within Europe. It might have changed when it moved to the east coast of the US and then changed again as it moved west within the US. It might change when it moves into Asia in a different way, et cetera. So that's sort of a blanket statement. When it comes to like fra diavolo, shrimp scampi is really just people saying shrimp scamp, like it's redundant, right? And then it refers to
day prawns.
Yeah, exactly. So it refers to a dish now, but basically it's just a kind of conflagration of Italian and English references to the idea of the dish. And then the idea of something like lobster fra diavolo, the making a spicy sauce, absolutely Italian. Putting it on a variety of things, yeah, probably also. Putting on lobster, you're not going to see that in Italy because lobster is considered delicious and delicate, and it's just unlikely. It's just an unlikely pairing for the Italian palate. Also worth noting that there aren't that many places in Italy where you will have spicy dishes, period. Calabrian toe of the boot, for the huge exception, where a very spicy food is eaten everywhere within that region.
Not that spicy.
Okay, if you come from like a Lombardian palate and you like bring somebody, I can't tell you how often I'm in Calabria, somebody is like, I order something, they say, are you sure you want that? I say, yes, despite being a small woman and American, I do really want this. I promise. I know how spicy it is. I will eat it in abundance and with glee when you bring it, I swear. And we have a back and forth. Then they watch in horror as I vacuum it into my mouth without even pausing to take a sip of wine. And then they only, of course, further cement their ideas that American women are hussies and dangerous, and then move on from there. But anyway, spiciness is not really an Italian specialty across the board.
Okay, there was a great question from Anne G regarding the distinction that Danielle made between fish meals and meat meals. Where did vitello tonnato originate? How and why? And I want to just jump in and say there are some cases in which you have meat and canned tuna fish together.
Yes.
Chopped up in a rice salad with canned corn and pickled vegetables, cubes of Swiss cheese, Emmental, and canned tuna, and a big squirt of mayo. Inside olive ascolane, meat is mixed with like breadcrumbs and tuna, and just scraps, whatever, anything. And then vitello tonnato, of course, has that sort of tuna mayonnaise on a cold slice of veal. Over to you.
When you say it like that, it's like, who wouldn't want it?
People tell me all the time. That's what they say.
So vitello tonnato is specifically a kind of remnant or holdover from the court cooking of the northwest of Italy. And it won't surprise you to hear that for anybody who is familiar with the kind of splintered early modern history and politics of Italy, where the south was part of first Spanish dominion, then interbourbon, and then the center of Italy was dominated by the papal states and then broken up into a variety of duchies and city-states. And the north of Italy was part of the what would become later the Kingdom of Savoy and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and et cetera. There's also some bishopric of Trent and other stuff. The French influence was, of course, very strong, particularly as you move into the 18th and 19th centuries. The French court was rich and well-established, and the French culinary canon, thanks to the militarization of the kitchen, that sounds like I'm making a joke, but I'm not, the brigade, that's where it comes from, was a very clearly canonized model that moved more easily from European context to European context. And so the ultra-wealthy aristocratic and sometimes royal households of the far north of Italy were really cooking in a continental, what we would now call a continental tradition. And the vitello tonnato was a vautonné in French, and became something that migrated and moved in a couple of different ways, and that was present in this kind of Italo-Francophone space. Flash forward to the 20th century, when it becomes pretty hip again, because it just really fits in with like a 1980s understanding of how to make something that looks slick for a dinner party, but is ultimately pretty easy to put together.
I think it looks really good next to the mashed potatoes shaped like a fish.
Yes. Listen, I'll tonnare anything you put in front of me. You just watch me.
So this actually, I think, is another one for you from Tony. Actually, Tony also asked, what about eel? Any favorite or recommended preparations? Chop it up, fry it. Tony also asked, are corporate conglomerates starting to endanger the local markets for fish in Palermo's Buccidio?
This is more for me than you. I would throw this to you.
I mean, I think in Palermo, what you have is a really unique, and at this point in Italian commerce history, pretty rare. There's a lot of direct-to-consumer selling. There still are small fishing boats, but I don't think there's any fish market or fish business in Italy that isn't impacted by the large-scale fishing industry and the companies that disregard the laws, which impacts the environment on many levels, but also the availability of what is found in the markets. When you mentioned the strip along the Bay of Palermo, where you can go and like people are plucking things out of the sea, there's a lot of free diving. Like, it's not impacting that market, but that's also an illegal market. Like, people aren't allowed to fish directly from the sea and sell it to you for cash on the street. So in a way, the vibrance of the availability of fish in Palermo is still alive until authorities crack down on that. Other eel preparations for Tony?
Oh, I mean, eel is a tough one. Real Italian eel is not like the ones that you would get here, because we mostly get them from Asia. What I would say that what I will, here's what I'll give you. I'll give you one that comes from Dante that I'm always talking about, which is to boil eels in white wine, which is supposedly how Martin IV died. And actually a bunch of other medieval royalty apparently just like could not stop eating eels to the point of death. But boiling them in white wine is an ancient and very popular way of cooking them. And it worked because eel have a ton of natural fat on them. So unlike other things where you would not want to boil them and risk getting toughening the meat, eel boiled can be very good. But it's funkier, I think, than a lot of people are used to. I enjoy it very much, but yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And the way that Cesare, the eel fisherman, the one lone eel fisherman left on the Tiber, prepares them, he boils them in water with white vinegar and chops them into smaller pieces, pats them dry, flours them, deep fries them, serves with a side of lemon.
Well, speaking of good ways of eating things, we have one question from an anonymous fan about your favorite Boston Italian restaurant, which seems fair because the UMass Italian Center who is sponsoring this wonderful event today. So we better tell everybody where they should go get food after we've made them hungry right now. Katie, you have a favorite in the Boston area?
I don't remember.
Okay. Well, here, why don't we start with this? That's true. But what I was going to say is, where would you buy things right now? Because it's a pandemic, so most people aren't eating out anyway. Or if they are, they're just getting takeout. Where do you love to get your ingredients in the Northeast generally? People in Boston, it doesn't have to be in the center of Boston.
Formaggio Kitchen's in Boston, I think, right, Cambridge?
Yes, you got it.
Not the same, don't come at me. But yeah, totally. Oh, Julia's very good. Thank you, Jason. Thank you.
That was going to be mine. Yeah.
Yeah.
I also, for wines and Italian cheeses and meats, I love the Wine and Cheese Cask. I go there myself and I also source wines there for tasting in the Boston area all the time. Really great selections there. Shout out to Kim who does their wine buying. I think there are a ton of great places that are doing great food in the Italian style in the Boston area right now. But I actually have to say that I don't know how most people are operating right now. So I'm more inclined to push you towards the grocers like Formaggio Kitchen that Katie is emphasizing, because I know that you'll be able to get really fine products and create a nice meal. And Katie and I just recorded another episode yesterday where we were talking about how an Italian meal is coursed out. And we've been encouraging everybody to make food at home by patronizing the places that you love, either the restaurants, if they're doing grocery or pre-prepared food, or the shops, and then making a proper meal at home with all of that stuff and giving yourself that kind of a full meal. And as we're talking about, if it's with fish, that means starting with crudo or raw fish preparation, then having cooked antipasti, then having a pasta primo with fish, then having a whole fish, and then moving on to your contorno and dolce, your salad and dessert. And when it comes to those kinds of meals, I think it brings us perfectly to our very last question, which we will permit from a special guest who's on here, asking what we will be doing if we can for ourselves for a special meal. And Katie, we actually have managed to, thanks to the phenomenally good weather here in Los Angeles, eat a couple of things together outside in the sunshine. Mostly been tacos. Some of those have contained fish. Where would you go? Where would we go right now if the world was open for business for fish? Where would we go in the whole world if we could go right now?
Sardinia, man.
Yeah, I'm there with you. I would do Carloforte, jump on the ferry, and have a pesto alla Carlofortina, maybe.
I mean, I would also hit East Olympic and do some of the fish taco trucks. That's 12 miles from here.
That we could do. That feels very doable. One of the two. Yeah, I like it. I hope that everybody gets to eat something really delicious after they've been here and given us their amazing attention and all of these phenomenal questions. I think we should do this more often. What do you say?
I concur. And in the meantime, I encourage everyone to catch up on the Gola podcast, GolaPodcast.com is our website. You can subscribe wherever you get your pods. Please like and review and share the podcast with your pals. And you can follow us and see what we're eating, sometimes together, sometimes apart, at Dr. Caligari's Cabinet and at Katie Parla.
And let's, just before we sign off, thank once again the Catherine Fusone Scott Center for Italian Studies at UMass, which supported this event, and the department, and I did remember it after a moment earlier, for Modern Languages, Literatures, and Cultures at UMass Boston. And of course, our wonderful host and who invited us here today, Professor Shannon McHugh, for facilitating. And once again, all of you for your incredible. We look forward to seeing you in person, hopefully in the not too far future. We hope that you'll listen to the podcast. We hope you'll eat well and patronize all of the fine Italian food and wine establishments wherever you are. And we will hopefully see you in Italy again in 2021 and in the future. Arrivederci.
Alla prossima.